Today I'm joined by gardening superstar, multi-gold medal winning Chelsea designer as he spits his tea out, and all-round top bloke, Mr. Adam Frost. Adam, thank you for talking to us today.
Did you write that? Did someone write that?
I wrote that because it's very, very true. Now, I think let's rewind back a couple of months ago and talk quickly about our joint submission to the Culture Media and Select Committee. Do you want to tell listeners a bit about what we suggested in terms of promoting British gardens and the idea of a competition?
It got further than I thought it would, actually.
It was the prime recommendation to government, no less.
Yeah. Bless, yeah, I mean, you and I sort of, I suppose, first of all, we connected online, didn't we? And then you came down and we were chatting about different things to do with gardening, the effect of gardening, I suppose, physically, mentally, environmentally as well. And what could we do? You told me about, you know, the tourism bit that was online, and we came up with this little sort of policy. And one of those ideas within that was actually... we've got the European City of Culture, that maybe we could have the sort of garden of, I can't remember what we actually called it, mate. What did we call it?
The garden city competition.
Yeah. So that each city, X amount of years, had money to put into their green infrastructure. I think as an idea, it's worked. So for me, it still works in the set that we're losing a lot of our parks. You know, they're getting run down. They haven't got money. It would be nice just periodically to appear at different parts of the country and try and put a green infrastructure and hub back into that city, large town, or whatever it wants to be, and see if you can build a community around that green space.
Now, I think we're a tad disappointed that government then decided to ignore the recommendation, but do you still think there's something to be said with regards pressing government to engage more with garden-related issues?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like anything, isn't it? It's nice when, you know, we've been through what we have, just the new government, but across the board, there was proper environmental policies, which for me, ultimately, a lot of that goes on outside your back door, you know. So anything that we can engage government with, I mean, the thing I've got going on at the moment, that I was at a conference yesterday, is about biosecurity. We're in a bit of a mess when it comes to the things that we've not only have we brought into the country, but the things that sit across in Europe and could arrive. And we went to a conference yesterday and there was members of government there, and you got the sense that they're starting to realise that it's important. We have conversations with, you know, health departments. The RHS have developed a relationship with our sort of head psychiatrist, and that's a conversation about, you know, how you look at loneliness, you look at health, well-being. You know as well as anyone, it's being a green space, you know, it fixes people. And I think the disconnect is, even if you look at the health thing, it seems to be becoming understood on a clinical level, but it boils back to the same thing all the time, is it's about pound notes, isn't it? You know, and it's either someone can save a lot of money or make a lot of money, they're not interested. But you just hope that at some point someone gets it, that there's a business case in this, not just a personal thing. And it's not just a nice thing to do, it fixes people.
Totally agree. I recently took the opportunity to push newly appointed, and one of the environment ministers, now Lord Goldsmith, on Pete, no less. Now, I've known him for, I guess, around about 25 years, from when he edited The Ecologist magazine. He very helpfully told people who cared about the use of Pete, or rather not to use Pete, to badger their MP and to badger DEFRA. I think the quote was covered in this month's Gardener's World. Many people are going Pete-free. I assume you support such a move, but given your background.
Yeah, with me, I mean, I sort of, you know, I'm looking around now, you know, I was 21 years old, went to work for Jeff Hamilton. I can remember him saying, right, we're going to use this stuff, it's called Koi. And all right, Nick, his son, got it instantly, and I was a little bit, I'd been brought up very much on Pete, and I don't think as a youngster I'd even necessarily registered with me that there was a point of issue. And I think then working that time with Jeff and him explaining, you know, why he was doing it, I naturally have just always used peat-free materials. I think the problem with anything like that is that we can only, you can only have a guide and give information. I don't think any of us should be in a place where you're starting to dictate or telling people what they should do, because I think when you do that, it doesn't always end well. So I think you give the information, you say, look, if you care about this, this is this point of view, but at the same time, you know, the peat industry's got a point of view.
Yeah. Do you think then it's more about, from what you said, it's more about educating people? Because strangely enough, I can sit in a garden centre and you can watch people's buying habits, and quite often they'll buy what's in front of them. So it's about, you know, they can, at the end of the day, they can take that choice as long as they're educated into what the impact of their choice is. And at the moment, perhaps people don't know what the impact of buying peat is.
I think you're right in that sense. I don't think, it's like with an awful lot of things, isn't it? We go in and we buy things not necessarily, and that's across a whole array of things, and we just rock on with it. I think with me, one of the conversations as well is that, you know, it's a lot of people go straight to multi-purpose, whether that's peat or peat-free, and then think that that's going to solve all your gardening problems. And in reality, with me, it's, you know, my base is my multi-purpose, and then I've got my gravels, I've got my sands, I've got my perlites, I've got my vermiculites, you know, and I've got new soil now again as well, and I build my mixes depending on what I'm trying to do, you know. But I think it's interesting, isn't it, because you go back 30 years ago, Jeff was talking about peat-free, organics, stop destroying our countryside.
It's taken a while to get there again.
Wow, you just think, you know, so I suppose with me, it's just become what it is, and I get on with it, because...
Can you see a time, though, when the things you spoke about will actually be the norm? Whereas at the moment, they're possibly still not there.
Yeah, they're normal with me, because they're just like, I wouldn't do anything different. But I think, I definitely think there's a change in the mindset. I think there's a change in the mindset of, in a sense, the peat industry. I think, obviously, you know, certain legislations have started to come in to affect things. You see a lot more work put in now to, you know, green waste, to, you know, to sort of peat free. And I think reality is, with me, and this probably applies to all of us, me included, and probably, I'm going to say you, and then you're going to shoot me down, is that so many of us gotten used to living a linear life. You know, so, you know, we get it, we use it, we dispose of it, we get it, we use it, dispose of it. And now, you know, we've got to be more circular, you know, so everything's got to come back. And I'm adjusting that, but it's not an easy thing to do.
I mean, I've always argued, it's just one of the things that, and people will laugh at me given the recent weather, I will try on my, and it's a big enough plot, 2 acres, never to use the tap. I can afford to use the tap, yeah. But I think at some point, and certainly around the globe, that water is a huge issue. We don't store enough in this country. Yeah, new builds aren't built to store it. So I will store 20,000 litres in pig ugly IBCs. But I'm lucky because I've got the space to do it.
Yeah.
But that's kind of one of my moral choices. It's a bit of a victory for me when I can get through a dry summer and say I've used all literally water that's washed off my house.
Yeah,
and there are issues like that people, you know, will make their moral choices depending on. Sometimes it's purely down to money.
Yeah, it is, and I think that ultimately is always going to be, you know, it's the elephant in the room, isn't it? Is that I think the majority of people, we all want to live slightly different lives or slightly different way from the way that we live in. But a lot of the time, I think pound notes stop people from doing that. You know, I think you look at something like the plastic thing that got talked a lot about on Gardener's World, and reality is, you know, the black pots don't get picked up within you know, within the system. So, you know, recycling plastic, this, that, the other, how you do that. I started to look into that, and I've started doing a bit of work with a charity called Recoup. Oh, it is a complex subject, you know, and I'm now actually going to go right back to the beginning and look at how Recoup helped these different people. So I've got booked in the diary actually to go to a recycling centre to totally and utterly understand, you know, what gets picked up, why it doesn't get picked up, what's still done manually, you know, because there's so many different types of plastics. Some of it can go back into a mainstream, some of it can go back into food, some of it maybe our black
pots. And I guess the collection depends on which local authority you live in. I know, I'm not sure it's true. Someone told me where I live that it's hand-picked. Everything that goes in the recycling bin is hand-sorted.
And from what I understood from Recoup, that a lot of it is still, you know, it more or less goes through two or three different times. And you think, well, you know, someone stood there trying to pick bits out. I know a lot of it does get done mechanically, and us washing something out and putting it away, that makes a huge difference. Because I think what they were saying to me was, ultimately, is the stuff that doesn't go back clean becomes even more of a problem. But it's like anything, isn't it? The moment you start looking at it, you realise that any issue that we've got to deal with is far more complex.
It was noted, for my sins, I worked at Boots, and we looked at the plastic bag issue in 2003. It's only now that I believe they've stopped giving bags at all. The reason and they gave 300 million plastic bags out a year. Wow. The reason they didn't stop doing plastic bags was because at the time the company was tasked with reporting its transport CO2 emissions, and the mere shipping of paper bags, which are that, they don't seem that much bigger when you've got one, but a box of 500 is probably about 10 times bigger than a box of 500 plastic ones. Yeah. So the emissions on your transport would have shot up. And that's why at that time the decision wasn't taken to go to paper, which also has its own environmental issues anyway.
Well, and I think there's that, isn't there? Everything that you read now, you know, we shouldn't drive that, we should drive this, we shouldn't do that, we should do that. And then you go to the, oh, right, so I should be doing that now. No, I shouldn't be doing that because that person said that that's not doing what it's meant to be, and actually what I think I'm doing good, I'm not really.
There's always a smart aleck that's got another answer as to why what you're doing is bad. Yeah. Well, I went to get my peak free in my car. Well, you know, there's more microplastics coming off your tyres, so you shouldn't do that. and that's where I worry that if people do that with the best intentions, people just get annoyed and think, right, I'm not bothering.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think it's like all of us, really. We've got to find... We're just guided by your own moral compass, and you live by, you know, your own set of moral rules, and you decide it. I don't think other people dictating to you is ever going to change anything, because human beings do have a tendency, don't they, go, stuff that, I'm not doing it, you know.
You know, my background was in the world of politics, which is why I've always said I found plants and gardening far more civilised.
Obviously, because it is.
Absolutely. But obviously politics, I guess, impacts our lives in terms of decisions. So in terms of the benefits of gardening, you've mentioned some of these issues. What would you want our decision makers to be aware of more? Is it benefits to mental and physical health? Is it the importance of green spaces? Is it showing a career in horticulture is a legitimate career choice? Is it indeed plant health, which we'll come on to in a moment, your garden that you're designing? Or is it that and more?
Yeah, wow. That's not a question, mate. That's like a major...
That's an essay.
It is. Like, you know, I think you're trying to turn me into an MP, aren't you? That's what it is. You're going to become my, you know, my...
Your agent.
Agent and officer, yeah. I think, do you know what? I'm going to go right back to the beginning. First time that I feel that sort of politics, in a sense, really affected my life and horticulture. I think it left a big mark and a big problem within horticulture. Lots of people disagree, probably, is when Maggie, bless her, thought privatisation was the answer for everything. I honestly don't think it was for the old parks departments. I think the parks departments were that place where this country churned out good apprenticeship driven gardeners. So I think that, for me, I'd love us to relook at that. I think our public spaces in general, like anything, you know, if you're a garden designer, mate, all right, and you know, or you're a landscaper and you turn up to a, you know, a new building, it's a big project, and the architect's there, the engineer's there, and they're all there, yeah, and then there's you. And realistically, 99 times out of 100, you know, it's all set off with good intentions that the landscape will be a major part of that project. 9 times out of 100, actually what happens is we cut the budget because actually we've overspent on this, we've overspent on that, so you can have 3 trees now, not 23 trees. I'd love to be in a place where it was just the norm, the outside space was important as the inside space. I think people that garden, people that are in my industry, totally, utterly get it. You said, you know, you've found it. I think people get it. So I would love there to be more public money for public spaces, but those public spaces have got to be used properly. So I think that idea of a sense of community and taking people and using these spaces, they can't become dangerous. That can solve helps mental health, it can do loneliness, it can do, you know, fitness, well-being, it can tick so many boxes for, you know, our health department. And then after that, environmentally, I think that the way that we treat our own back gardens and the wider landscape, we can all play our part environmentally. And I suppose lastly, is the thing that I'm working on at the moment about the biosecurity and the mess that we're in, and now what we've got to deal with and how we deal with that. I think that is going to take some investment in research to help going forward.
Well, that
is that, was that like a policy statement?
Yeah, that's it. I think we're either going to get you elected or we've got some good campaigns that we need to work on. Be it public, renewed public parks, which I think is a fascinating issue, and we could do more on that. So we'll talk privately on that. But you've brought me nicely on to issue of biosecurity and plant health. I know that you've discussed those issues with the likes of Prince Charles on more than one occasion. Is that an issue that should be top of the horticultural agenda, and why should we as gardeners all be concerned?
Wow, yeah, it's massive. We're over 1,000 pests and diseases on a DEFRA list. You know, I mean, I suppose the thing that will sit with everybody at the moment is something like ash dieback. We're losing millions of ash trees, so that's well and truly. But you know, the garden that I'm doing at Chelsea is all about plant health, though. So it's in sort of line with the International Year of Plant Health. And you look at something like Zyala. So let's take that as one thing at the moment that has caused so much problems down in Italy, wiped out all the olive groves. That's cost that country I don't know how many billions of pounds. So something like Zyala, 2 years ago when I first started, did an interview with Prince Charles on for garden as well, I think there was about 200 varieties of plants that would affect, you know. Now that list is over 500. Will it rock up? Most experts think at some point it will rock up on our shores. There's more than one strain of it, so it becomes complex. How much damage those strains will do is complex as well. But we could be in a place where we are losing, you know, things like rosemary are on there, lavender are on there. There's major plants that are everyday part of our lives. So not only will our gardens take a whacking, but our wider landscape will as well. And
I guess one of my biggest fears is that it will be a gardener who brings something like that to this country. I've lost count, certainly when you look at certain gardening forums online, and these are people who are actually interested in gardening as opposed to people who aren't, who will absolutely just say, well, you know, I've got this cutting and I put it in my bag, that won't hurt.
It'll be all right.
This isn't about laying blame, but is there still a lot of ignorance around?
Yeah, and I don't think it is about laying blame. I think the one thing that you find with a lot of keen gardeners is it's always, oh, I'd love a bit of that. I'd love that in my garden. And just a little bit won't matter, will it? And that conversation came up yesterday at this conference. And, you know, people that know that, you know, they know all the rules, they say that they personally have to go, I can't do this. I can't do it. I can't do it. You know, it's sort of, so yeah, we just shouldn't do it. End of, you know, we just can't do it, you know, and the regulation is really starting to tighten up. You know, I think if you want to bring something personally back into the country, you're going to have to be in a place where you actually go and get it certificated and bring it back in. You're not really going to want to do that on your holiday. So I think that things are starting to tighten up. That information that sort of legislation, I suppose, will take time on it.
Do you think, on that, do you think we need to be tougher with regards, even through official channels, imports into this country, perhaps?
Yes, I think that we do. That said, at the same time, you know, you go to parts of Europe and some of their biosecurity rules and regulations are much better than ours. So I think it's those countries that we need to build the good trading relationships with, and that, I think, can be certificate driven. I think there's conversations going on about the idea of, you know, the red tractor type idea on plants, so you either know that it's British grown and it comes from here, but if not, the plant passport system, you know, all those regulations now should be on labels, so you start to actually know where your plants are coming from. And I think a lot of it for us as gardeners, it's just asking more questions.
We're nearly coming on to what you're up to at the moment, but could you ever envisage a flower show whereby the rules would be that it has to be UK sourced, not just for plant health reasons, but the fact that when you see plants being sourced and flown in from all over the world, some people will question that purely in a sustainability concept. And you know, you could look at Chelsea and sustainable isn't really key at the moment, when you'll just see on television as an outsider, well, those cut flowers were flown in. So irrespective of plant health, could you ever see that happening, or is it more that this is a showcase? And actually,
I think on a personal opinion, I can see it coming in, because I've gone back far enough to know that, you know, when I first started all this, it wasn't on the agenda at all, and it's now on the agenda. I think it's like anything, it will take time, but I definitely think I can see us slowly moving in that direction. Whether, you know, we never bring anything is a different conversation, because I think it's like anything, you know, are we just going to have British cars? Are we just going to have this, that? So I don't think in reality that'll ever happen, but what I do think is, you know, legislation and regulation will tighten up so we're less at risk than we are at the moment, you know.
Now, I'm sitting in front of, it doesn't really work well on a podcast with no video, but I'm sitting in front of this, to me, at this amazing model of a garden. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing at Chelsea this year?
It's the rantings of a mammon at the moment, mate. It's got loads of little pins all in it with all these plant names all over the place. I've sort of agreed to go back after, in 2015, saying I wouldn't. I left with the caveat of saying, oh, I might come back for the Triangle, which is this massive plot at the end of Main Avenue. I think it's about 50, see that, mate, is scaled, all right? So you've got about 52 metres between that end and that end.
Just a small one then.
And 19 days to build it. I've gone back because of the importance of the issue and what we're talking about, and so it's for the RHS, but it's also supported by various different bodies, government, i.e. DEFRA, Horticultural Trades Association. I can't now list off, but there's 8 or 9. I think there's some support from Scotland, from Wales, from all over the place. It's trying to bring public awareness to ultimately the biosecurity problem. I started designing it and started trying to create, and we did a load of research. There's a girl in the office called Caitlin who's a little diamond, and she's basically trained in plant pathology, so she's massively into all this stuff. And she was, you know, we were pulling off this research that was European, the DEFRA research, the RHS, and then more than one occasion I've got really upset in the, you know, the soft old sod that I am, you know, there's tears running down my face, and how did we get here, you know? And that led me to words of loss and love, and then that led me to a couple of songs that I've been listening to, because most people that do know me know that I'm a soft old sod, really. And then those songs started to drive the design, and one of those songs is about, if you only had one love, would you not treat it just a little bit better, you know? And I thought, actually, if I apply that to a garden and I could just create one garden, what would it be like, and that's what I've done. So I've looked back at sort of classic British gardens, taken the elements, put a twist on them, but it's divided into two halves. So the idea is the public can move through the middle of this garden, but these wooden blocks here that you can see, they represent two, in my head, I suppose, gatehouses, you know, classic gatehouses. They probably look more like barns, Tom. I've finished them. But you go into these buildings, and within that, originally I wanted the whole 1,000 pictures of pests and diseases. I can't do that. So it looks like I'm going to end up with the sort of the top 100 problems in pictures form. But within there, some moving images. So, you know, on screens that not only talk about problems, but actually talk about the things that we can do as gardeners, and we're hoping that that information, everybody that goes through, that that information, people can more or less zap it, take it home and digest it further. So you get to the central space, you look one way and you can look the other way and through the other building and out. And then the garden itself, if you look one way where you can see my lovely little my hedges there, I suppose it's going to be my take on a knot garden, and then we build out from there with sort of classic elements, and then at the end there's an ode to the countryside. But that side of the garden is going to be planted with plants that carry problems of varying degrees. So some of it will be, I've humanised it in my head, so it's coughs, colds, but then ultimately right through to full depth. And I think people are going to see things on there. You go, wow, I didn't realise that.
So do you hope people, in one way, one takeaway for people is that it will worry the hell out of people, that in a sense that some plants are on there that, oh God, I didn't know that was under threat or that had disease.
Yeah, I mean, it's meant to, it's public awareness. So I think, you know, if it has the same effect on people like it did me, people are going to be a little bit stopped and go, well, I didn't realise this was this serious. And that is part of why we're doing it, is that, you know, if Zyla does rock up and you've got a garden planted with X, you might be in a bit of bother, you know? And so that sits as an ornamental, and then at the end of there is my ode to the countryside, because I think the research we did and started to build our lists of plants that were going to be affected, you realise that your gardens, as gardeners, we'll change and evolve, because what we'll do is we'll start, if things do suffer, we'll replace them, and so gardens will evolve over a period of time. The countryside will take a good whack, you know, and then you look at sort of woodlands, you look at monocultures that are planted, and you think, well, if a monoculture, you know, there's problems with larch, if a monoculture, you know, you look at the different phytophthora, you look at the oaks are under threat, and if you've got a monoculture and you've got one problem, that's it. You're gone. So we'll have a divide of a monoculture hedge, a group of monoculture trees, and then wildflower in there that could suffer. And then on the good side, on the positive side, it's going to be planted with all plants that don't carry problems at the moment. And what I mean by that is, even in the last few weeks, I've lost two things from the good side to the bad side. That's how much it's changing at the moment. And I think that's partly because obviously we're becoming more aware. And then what will happen is that will be divided at the end with a mixed hedge, if I can find enough things to plant my mixed hedge, and a group of trees that maybe we might see in our landscape in the future. And I'm having those conversations with people that really understand their trees, you know. So I was talking yesterday to a fellow called Tony Kirkland, who's a mate of mine, who looks after all the trees at Kew, you know, and he's got his opinion. And then I was talking to Garen, who looks after all Prince Charles. He's got his opinion on what we might be planting in the future. And I'm going to listen to these guys and take a sort of a judgment call as to, you know, what we might see in our woodlands.
So in one way, one side could be almost possibly a garden of the past, because some of these plants may sadly disappear, rightly or wrongly.
I mean, I'm hoping ultimately not, because I think that, you know, if a lot of the time nature sorts itself out, that's the reality. You know, we just will need time. I mean, it's quite interesting, isn't it, with the ash problem. You know, the first call was cut all the ash down, and then it was like, whoa, hold on, some of these are still all right. And then they started looking at the ones all right, and then looking at the DNA and the strains and this, and started to develop maybe a generation of trees that could deal with the particular problems. And it's quite interesting, again, they were talking about this conference yesterday, is when you start to look at the makeup of those trees, they're changing their, you know, the chemical balances inside them to fight off these particular things. I mean, I'm constantly just blown away by nature, and you just go, oh, really? I think the answer's out there to sort everything, isn't it?
Well, it's what we spoke about privately, how small changes, literally in a short space of time, I'm convinced can make a huge difference. And I just see it being surrounded by monoculture farmland and farmers thinking I'm crazy doing what I'm doing all the time because you could put sheep on it, and you get rid of some non-native conifers that were awful and falling down and put native hedge in and leave wood piles, and all of a sudden, you know, the farmer next door says he's never seen a grass snake yet. I've seen three. There's a reason for that.
Yeah, totally, mate. I mean, it goes back to the old thing, doesn't it? If you build it, they will come. I mean, I manage a garden in quite a... I suppose I tried to back off. I'm sure some people turn up here on our courses and think he's not got that very tidy, but that's part of what it like. And that comes from a Jeff thing. I remember that, you know, when Jeff passed away and Nick opened the garden, you know, lots of people came in and were blown away, but there was a fair amount of people saying, well, they've let it go since Jeff died, and know that nobody had let it go. That was just the way that Jeff gardened. I don't know, I look back on that time with him and the wisdom of a man 30 years ago, and you go, wow.
Almost up getting goosebumps. Before his time. Yeah. When we spoke that, you know, speaking about peat free, speaking about not spraying, it's taken a generation, perhaps.
Yeah, incredible, you know, and those people don't come along very often, do they? And it's interesting, yesterday, listening to Prince Charles, and whatever your opinions are on the royals or on him, you know, that man passionately cares about our landscape. And when you hear him speak, not only does he passionately care about it, he understands the subject. And he was in the same boat as Jeff, wasn't
20, 30 years ago, he was seen as a bit of a fruitcake talking to trees, would be what the papers would write.
Exactly. And you look now and, you know, he's being viewed in a slightly different way. And people are going, yeah, you had a point, son. You had a point. And I think that, yeah, maybe we're all in a place where we just need to stop and take a breath and just work out how we're going to move forward.
Speaking of crazy people, as you know, I'm embarking on my own challenge this year. Trying for laughing away, that's not helpful. Trying for the National Collection of Alseas, Hollyhocks, through Plant Heritage, who are an extremely helpful and nice charity. Am I mad?
Of course you are. Hollyhocks are a pain in the neck. Maybe you should have chosen an easier subject.
I could have done Cosmos.
Yeah. Because you've got to grow more from seed, haven't you?
Yeah, everyone.
You've got to grow more from seed. Yeah. And then what do you have to do? If they have individual plots, how do you have to deal with it? Because obviously, within that, what happens about cross-pollination and all that sort of stuff? Because this is an interesting thing that you could explain to people.
I've done individual plots, so it looks like a big chessboard. That there is plastic, it's weed matting, just to separate them. Each one then will then have to be labelled, and my wife, because she's better at it than me, this isn't a sexist thing, is going to sew some enviro mesh to isolate the flowers so that they don't cross-pollinate, so that I can then pollinate probably with a little paintbrush. So go and buy 100. I've got, I think, 70 different hollyhocks, depending if they all grow. And I remember a sheep farmer saying that sheep were literally an animal that wanted to die because everything would try and make it die, and you have to stop it. And I'm seeing that with hollyhocks, that they're literally a plant that wants to die. That's its choice, and you're having to try and not let it die. So given it's been that damp, they've been put in the polytunnel because the gales obliterated one of the greenhouses. I've got a fan in there to try and dry them out a bit, because if they get too wet, they get fungal, this, that and the other. I'm not spraying them with antifungal stuff because that kills bees. So I'm doing various other bits and bobs. I'm putting biochar in the ground because that's meant to help sort of get you a stronger plant. So yeah, it's interesting. I guess, you know, what other advice would you give me other than what I'm doing?
I just love the fact, it's just wonderful. And you know what I love? I love the fact that sort of you've left the world of politics and we've sucked you in to the world of horticulture.
I've come over to the point. I was on the dark side. I've come over.
But now to the point of like, oh, I'm going to grow all these things.
I'm doing it.
It's brilliant, mate. And you know what? I wish you all the best. And you know, even if it doesn't all work, and with the gardening, with anything, some of it will be brilliant, some of it won't, and that's part of the process.
I guess on a serious note, would you encourage more people to do this kind of stuff, because it is about trying to preserve plant species that and I was shocked, and this again was no criticism, that there were so many various plants that I would call common popular plants that no one was prepared to do this. Now, I know I'm lucky. I say it's not all luck. It's getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to be able to afford 2 acres in Lincolnshire, where it's cheaper than living in London and all the rest of it. So there's a lot of hard work that goes into it. But I was shocked that so many of these species, of these taxons, the various whatever, that no one was doing it.
Yeah, no, it's in a lot of ways, you know, the horticultural industry has fallen away over a period of time. You know, if you look back at the history, I mean, you only have to look at some of the, you know, the old family nurseries that now they're going through the generations and getting to a point of closing down. They either can't make it pay or someone within the family. That same knock on that you hear within, you know, the farming world happens in horticulture. But then on the positive, people like you are doing it. I think there's youngsters that are out there that have come through an education system and a world that they're waking up and going, I understand this environmentally and I want to make a difference. And I think that actually, for me, on the positive, I do think that there will be a pickup with gardening. I honestly think there will. I think that kids realise that maybe everything that goes on the phone is not the most important thing in the world, and gardening teaches you an awful lot of things, you know, patience, and that connection with what goes on outside your back door is incredibly important. And I think so. You're doing what you're doing, but then other people just coming in and doing their own back garden, everybody will play their part, and I think hopefully we'll pick it all up and run it again. You know, we'll run with it, if that makes sense. Not sure that helps you at all, mate, really, does it? It's sort of...
Yeah, I think you know, from my perspective, it's what I want to show is that, and this is no disrespect to what I would call professional horticulturalists such as yourself. I know you have forgotten more than I'll ever know with gardening. That's a fact. That if I can have a go and put some serious amount of effort into doing something like this, what I want to show is that anyone can have a go, and that I sometimes worry that people, when they watch television, will see perfect gardens. I know my wife sees perfect gardens and then will say, well, why isn't ours like that? And then worry that it can't be done. Whereas I'm always, well, give it a go because no one else is doing it.
But I also don't think there's such a thing as a perfect garden, you know. I think, do you know what, there's one difference between you and me? One really simple difference, right? I've just had a go for longer. That's all it is. You know, I'd started this as that high. I went as a 16-year-old. I've had enough people over the years to bash me with a stick and say, Frosty boy, you're not doing that right, not doing that. To get to a place and realise that so many people have got different opinions. And actually, ultimately, gardening is about having a go. That's what it's about. And if at the end of the day of being in the garden, you've got a smile on your face, then that having a go is proper worthwhile.
Well, on that note, you're invited when I do get the National Collection awarded. You're invited to come and cut the ribbon.
That'll be nice.
Adam Frost, thank you for talking to us today.
Cheers, pal.
To discuss sponsorship opportunities, email editor@toryradio.com. Do it now.